Welcome, everybody. This is David Marsh from OnFIF. I've got the great pleasure to be talking to Mark Sobel, who is an extremely experienced U.S. Treasury official who's just left the employment of the U.S. Treasury, having been for 40 years right at the top of international monetary and financial affairs. And Mark has been in his most recent mode for now more than a decade, has been the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Monetary and Financial Affairs at the U.S. Treasury since the year 2000, right up until more or less the present day, and also spent some time at the International Monetary Fund as the U.S. representative on the executive board. So, Mark, you bring this huge experience of international monetary affairs, and what I'd like to talk to you about today is the way that the United States and you yourself have been looking at the European sovereign debt crisis over the last decade, what happened basically after various things took place following the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, where you think we've got to now after the latest efforts by Mrs. Merkel and President Macron to reinforce the euro area, and then also a gaze into the crystal ball regarding the future. So quite a big agenda. So welcome, Mark. Now, you've spent a lot of time going around Europe over the years as part of Treasury delegations. When did you first have the feeling that things might be going wrong after the financial crisis, where Europe seemed to have a reasonably good crisis in the early years after 2008, 2009? When did you start getting a nagging feeling that all may not be well after all?
Thank you for having me. You know, I would say that obviously the events surrounding Greece in 2010 were a wake-up call for everybody in Washington.
Were you watching Greece with some intensity? Because we all remember that Greece got into monetary union in the early 2000s. There had been a few raised eyebrows that they managed to get in a couple of years after economic and monetary union started in 1999. And then things seemed to go relatively well, as they did for the whole euro area up until the financial crisis. And then, of course, we noticed that I think in 2009, the Greek budgetary figures were not what they had appeared to be. Was that also another warning signal even before the events of May 2010?
I have to say, in hindsight, I think that the policymakers mid to late 2000s up until later in 2007 were complacent and maybe lulled into false sense by the great moderation. So I think that we may not have been vigilant as we should have been. I think that commentary on policymakers throughout the world, not just in the United States.
I always remember, as somebody who myself was deeply connected with events in Germany, I do remember a certain feeling of, you know, the crisis wasn't a European crisis in 2008, 2009. Both the Chancellor, Mrs. Merkel, and the Finance Minister, Mr. Steinbrück, were reasonably self-contented, shall we say, about the fact that they thought that the crisis had emanated with Anglo-Saxon banking practices and it wasn't going to hit Germany. I think you probably felt that the Europeans were a little bit complacent at that time. Americans had responded pretty boldly to the financial crisis, and there was a feeling, particularly I think after Greece started to become a problem in 2010, that you wanted Europe to also respond with equal boldness. What were the feelings that you had in your mind then, and where did you see the limitations of European action?
Let me make two observations. And let me start with something you said about this being an Anglo-Saxon crisis. We certainly bear much of the burden of blame. There is absolutely no doubt about that in my mind. However, I do think that there were many weaknesses that were evident, especially in hindsight, in some of the continental European banks. There was a very strong reliance on wholesale funding in the banks, wholesale funding on the dollar markets. So I take some exception to the view that this could simply be seen as an Anglo-Saxon bank. And some of the bailouts in France and Germany were extremely large. To get to the second point of your question, I think you're absolutely right, David, that we felt that through our various alphabet soup, monetary policy facilities, through the TARP, through the recapitalization, through the stress tests and the like, that we had galvanized very forceful action in our banking system, which put the U.S. on a much faster path to recovery of its financial sectors. And in Europe, we felt the response was not as bold. And we certainly wanted to see a much faster and deeper response to the crisis. Now, obviously, the major area for responsibility lies with national governments, but certainly we felt there needed to be a European response itself. And I would say from the period between mid-2010, which is kind of when the Greek crisis came to fruition, and then through the period in mid-2012, shall we say, it was a deeply worrisome time for U.S. officials. We were deeply worried about contagion in the Eurozone. We wanted to see Europe put up a massive amount of money to quell potential pressures. As our economy began to come out of the crisis, say our Congress was certainly complacent, I think, about the risks in Europe. So there was a lot of pressure from the U.S. behind the scenes to say that Europe needed to step forward. It needed to provide the lion's share of financing. Europe is a rich area. It could afford it. We at Treasury were certainly satisfied with IMF involvement, but the IMF should be also involved with its expertise. But it should definitely have played a secondary financing role at the time.
Well, we'll get a little bit into the 2012 events and particularly this outright monetary transactions in a moment. But I don't want to get too far ahead of the story because you did, in fact, say something about the European banks that I wanted to come back to. You may remember that in May 2010, when the European Central Bank, prodded by the IMF, did decide to actually purchase some bonds of the weaker countries to help them out. This led to a great row with the Bundesbank in particular. And I do remember the former president of the German Bundesbank, who's unfortunately died in the meantime, Karl-Otto Perl, saying in a newspaper interview or a magazine interview that the main reason why that bailout was taking place through the bond markets or the efforts to shore up the bond markets through central banking action was indeed to help out the French and the German banks. So the point that you made was actually quite well known in, shall we say, more technical circles. It didn't really seem to get through to the politicians. I mean, that's one point. I think it's not as though the Europeans were entirely oblivious of the fact that you put forward there, but clearly it did get through to the higher echelons. Then the other point is that clearly you, as somebody with a huge amount of experience in Europe, and you started off in West Germany, after all, as an overseas officer in the early 1980s, you knew that Europe was a pretty complicated place. And America, although it's a complicated place as well, it's complicated in a different way. I mean, 28 countries as we are now, less than with one central bank, not everybody in the monetary union. It's incredibly difficult to get action at a centralized level. Did you take all that into consideration when you were, if you like, venting your frustrations, you and the administration, at the Europeans and their tardiness?
First of all, I wouldn't say we were venting frustrations. I think we're very goal-focused. We were more interested in getting results, which meant a lot of private discussions behind the scenes. Now, I think you're absolutely right to say that we did take into account the complexities of Europe, as you say. We have enough difficulties managing U.S. politics, of course, but in Europe, there are 28 countries, as you said, several are not in the euro. It took the United States about 125 years of existence before we got to a Federal Reserve. And
the Civil War as well. We don't want to think about that. Yeah.
And then another 20 years until we got the FDIC and the SEC. We fully appreciate that German taxpayers would be reluctant to support massive transfers to other countries or to be ceding sovereignty. So you're fully right. We appreciated the complexities. We understood we had to talk to Brussels, we had to talk to Berlin, we had to talk to Paris, and we had to talk to many others to try and get our message out. And again, we had to make the point that the answers couldn't just be at the country level. Even if we felt that countries did have major responsibilities for keeping their houses in order, but that we did need a European level response. So those were the seeds for massive engagement by Secretary Geithner, with Secretary Luke continued, and the president was deeply involved in well.
And of course, again, just one element from 2010 before we go on to something approaching the future, and it's very germane in the light of what we're talking about now. You remember that from his hospital bed, Finance Minister Schäuble came up with the idea of a European Monetary Fund, i.e. one wouldn't need to rely on the IMF for help, taxpayer-funded help for some of the countries in difficulties. That was actually to your point that Europe is a rich place and could look after itself. Do you remember what your reaction was, your and other officials? His plan was actually beaten back, as we all know, by Mrs. Merkel, although it's now somehow come to fruition again in the new guise 8 years later. What was your reaction then? Because in a way, they were agreeing with you by saying Europe is big and able enough to look after itself.
I think in the early days, you would have found privately skepticism that Europe had depth of technical expertise that the fund had in terms of designing programs, in terms of the requisite economic analysis. So I think that was one kind of point that weighed on our minds. I guess another strand of thought might have related to globalism versus regionalism and whether it would be better to have a broader international engagement. And I think if you think back to some of the debates that took place in the late 90s, so when the first Asian Monetary Fund proposal came out, I think you can see some semblance of similarity in the initial reactions to the EMF proposal, at least in my mind.
Yes, that's very much the case. During the period when we came up to 2012, when indeed it was the ECB that took action and not the European government, we did have that walk on the shore at Deauville in 2010, under which Mrs. Merkel and the then president in France, Mr. Sarkozy, did decide that there'd have to be the famous private sector involvement in a debt rescheduling or partial debt write-offs by Greece. That led to something of a frisson in the capital markets. Mr. Trichet, who was then the head of the ECB, was very much against it. What was the feeling of the US Treasury at that time about getting the private sector involved in some debt write-downs or write-offs?
There is no doubt that there was deep concern over the Deauville proposals. In the recent blogs that I wrote, there was concern about this idea of automaticity or write-downs, particularly at the time when the financial markets in Europe were unsettled. So it wasn't only a question of Greece, there were questions about Ireland and Portugal, Italy lurking in the background. The Deauville agreement between Merkel and Sarkozy, we felt, did set back European markets rather considerably. So the Treasury was completely in line with Jean-Claude Trichet's reasoning at the time.
But you could see in a way why Mrs. Merkel said that, because she felt she had political pressure at home that the bank should not be allowed to get off with relatively light punishment. And as Mr. Pearl's statement back in 2010 showed, there was a strong feeling that the banks were being let off relatively lightly. But I can see why the Treasury would have indeed sided with Mr. Trichet there, because of course that did lead to a lot of dislocation in the markets. And there was a very strong view at the ECB in particular that government debt had to be risk-free. It was used in collateral, used in all sorts of financing operations. And if you started to introduce the idea of risk into government debt of whatever hue, that would upset the financial markets. And indeed, that is what happened. I mean, looking back at all this and also taking into consideration what happened in 2012 when the European Central Bank did start to get involved in a big way, do you think it was just a failure of imagination by the Europeans that had they realized that this was a big issue, that they had to put a lot of money onto the table and get it in there up front ahead of any financial crisis? If they had done that, they could have actually saved quite a bit of commotion and upheaval and uproar and political mess later on, had they actually simply had that imagination to act earlier with a taxpayer-funded backstop of some sort.
There's many people in Europe. The debates were there. All sides were aired. I think there were those who definitely appreciated the arguments you just made and would totally support them. We have to remember the political dimension. I had said earlier that there was recognition that it was hard for German citizens to accept that they needed to make transfers to others in Europe. And given the politics in Germany, I think it was hard for Germany to mobilize support for transfers until it became painfully clear and obvious that such transfers were needed. So I think you had this kind of back and forth or hesitancy until the very end. So you had a stop-go pattern, maybe is the way to put it, in the German response. And I think that held Europe back. I think it's explainable for political reasons, but it definitely made the job harder for the reasons you said. And if I reflect back on 2011, I would say that the central thrust of U.S. financial diplomacy behind the scenes was to urge Europe to build a large firewall some have called this a bazooka, and to leverage up resources that were put forth in the EFSF and to try and leverage them, build them up to create enough firepower to quell pressures that might emanate.
Yes. The European Financial Stability Facility, that was the EFSF, wasn't it, which was partly backed by government money. And of course, what is so striking about that period in 2011, which you're talking about here, Mark, is that there were a couple of missions by Tim Geithner, the then Treasury Secretary, sometimes slightly clandestine, sometimes in the full blaze of publicity, to put forward some slightly technical but extremely important measures, such as, say, using the Bundesbank's SDRs, the special drawing rights that the Bundesbank had in their reserves, go towards some stabilization fund, or also the idea of leverage, getting this EFSF taxpayer-backed, taxpayer-guaranteed fund, getting that to be able to actually use this as firepower for borrowing. I think Tim Geithner went off on a visit to the Eurogroup meeting in Poland at one stage in 2011 and actually tried to get the finance ministers to agree somewhat more imaginative, technically sounding, but also politically perhaps slightly explosive ideas for putting more money on the table. And he was basically given short shrift, particularly on that Polish idea. And I think the idea of using the SDRs also ran into some very powerful opposition from Mrs. Merkel, who said that she couldn't possibly tell the Bundesbank what to do. Do you think after all these episodes, with the Americans really trying to get involved here, that the Americans decided, well, more or less, we'll let the Europeans stew in their own juice after this experience of being rebuffed?
You made a number of interesting observations. Again, our efforts were at the time to urge Europe to build the firewall, to put massive resources on the table if needed to stem potential contagion. And as you mentioned, we tried to put forward a number of creative financing options, guarantees. There was the debate about using SDR, special drawing rights at Cannes Summit, as you note, where we put forth ideas such as an allocation, which could then be mobilized, or an allocation which could enlarge the resources of the EFSF through leveraging almost CDO-type structures and the like. You correctly noted that the Bundesbank felt that use of the SDR in such a manner would constitute monetary financing and vetoed the idea. Did we think Europe could go stewing its own juices? I would say we never had that view. Again, come back to something I said earlier, we were very goal-oriented, task-oriented. We were deeply concerned about Europe in the 2010 to 2012 period and even afterwards, that there could be, shall we say, another Lehman moment in Europe, and that this would have huge repercussions, not only for Europe, but for the global economy and for the U.S. economy, as we were trying to dig ourselves from the great financial crisis.
I think that also solves the problem of why the Americans were doing this. We're all in the same boat.
You also mentioned, as emblematic of our diplomatic efforts in 2011, Secretary Geithner's visit to the Eurogroup. I think that was in September of 2011. He was invited by the Polish finance minister to offer his private personal remarks about what the U.S. had done post-crisis and whether there were lessons for Europe. He spoke again off the record. He indicated that he was humbled. He indicated he was not telling anybody what to do and was just offering some thoughts. Obviously, the focus was, again, on building the firewall and countering crises as vigorously as possible. The press ran some very interesting stories afterwards about the meeting.
By interesting, which, I take it, Mark, you mean wrong. Is that a polite way of saying wrong?
I think some people in Europe enjoyed speaking to the media rather than listening to the message.
Anyway, certainly that was done with the best of intentions. Well, thank you for clarifying that point. Now, this has been David Marsh talking to Mark Sobel, and we will be continuing this in the second part. But this brings a very good moment to bring down the curtain on the first part of our conversation, which takes us up to 2012, when the famous outright monetary transactions were promulgated. So this has been David Marsh talking to Mark, who until recently has been the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Monetary Affairs at the Treasury. Thank you for listening. And please do listen to the second part, which is available in a separate podcast, which will take us from 2012 up until the present day and beyond. Thank you.